James 1:2-1:3. The second talk in a series on James was presented by Ron Julian on December 11, 2005 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Good morning. We are in the book of James. Last week I took us through the story of James as we see it in various passages in the New Testament. I understand this letter to be written by James, the brother of Jesus, the leader in the Jerusalem church. I think he's writing to Jewish Christians early in the history of the church, Christians who are no longer in the Jerusalem area because they left because of persecutions that arose when Stephen was martyred. This letter then, I think, was written sometime in the first 15 years of the church before Paul started his ministry to the Gentiles. So the issue of the Gentiles has not really yet come up. James is writing using language that assumes that he's talking to Jewish Christians because in his mind that's who he's talking to. But he is not writing to the Jews as Jews. He is writing to them as followers of Christ. And so that means that the letter is just as relevant to a Gentile such as myself as are any of Paul's letters. There's nothing particularly Jewish about the letter. It's thoroughly Christian, I would argue. As we will see, James is not speaking personally to one group in the church. If you read something like Paul's letter to the Corinthians, you can almost feel that he's got in mind, okay, there's that guy who did this, and he's speaking to them as one who had started the church and lived there for a year and a half and so on. James' letter is not like that. It's addressed to the 12 tribes of the dispersion. Clearly, he intends it to be a circular sort of thing that is going to go around to a number of different communities of believers. He is, however, speaking in general to the conditions that he is aware of in those churches. So whereas he's not speaking to one specific person or one specific situation, he is talking about the circumstances in which they find themselves, and in particular, the way they have been responding to those circumstances. So it will be important for us to pay attention to the historical setting of the letter as we go along. Now, before I launch into the argument of the letter itself, let me just make a comment. He starts out by referring to my brethren. And it's a shame that I have to make this comment, but it has become so prevalent to take that phrase in a certain way that I need to kind of warn that that's not where I'm going. It's very common to hear people argue in this way. When a biblical author says, my brethren, that means he is speaking to Christians. That being the case, since they are Christians that he's writing to, the argument goes, nothing that he says has anything to do with salvation. He's talking to Christians, so he's just telling them what they ought to do. It would be better if they behaved this way. You could get rewards in heaven if you behave this way. Your life will go better if you behave this way. But nothing of an eternal nature really is at stake. My salvation is certainly not at stake because, after all, I'm a Christian. I really want to disagree strongly with that sort of perspective on these letters. Of course, when an apostle is writing to churches, he is going to call them my brethren. I mean, we can't really imagine him saying, dear friends who might be Christians or might not. I mean, it just wouldn't make any sense. But the fact is that it also wouldn't make any sense for a letter being addressed to a broad group to assume automatically that everyone there is a believer or that they don't need to hear things that have to do with the fundamental choice of whether to be a believer, whether to be a person of faith. Paul calls the Corinthians my brethren all the time, and yet he's saying things to them like, examine yourselves to see whether you are in the faith. I mean, and it's the brethren that he's speaking to when he says that. The reason I want to emphasize this is because the book of James, from my perspective, is entirely about this question of what does real faith look like? What's the difference between the real thing and the fake? And much of what he has to say is about how many of the people in the churches that he's writing to do not look in the way they live their lives as if they really believe this stuff. So although he's speaking to my brethren, I would say that he is actually giving a fundamental warning, exhorting and encouraging his readers to embrace the faith and not abandon it. So the issue in the book of James, I would argue, is salvation. Will you follow God and be saved or not? Is what the book is talking about from various angles. So the fact that he says, my brethren, at the beginning doesn't change the fact that there are fundamental issues at stake here. Okay, so this morning I want to look at just his first sentence after the introduction. We're looking at verses 2 and 3. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the proving of your faith produces perseverance. That's what I want to talk about this morning, and in order to bring out what James is getting at, I want to basically ask and answer four questions. So this morning I have four questions for you that I want to answer. The first of those questions is, what does he mean by trials? What are we talking about here? James uses two phrases. He talks about how, when we encounter various trials, and then he talks about the proving of our faith. Both of these phrases are speaking about very similar things, I think. The word trials comes from a very important word group in the Bible. It has to do with testing, the idea of testing something to see, is it true or is it false? Hebrews uses this word group to talk about how God tested Abraham in the famous story of when he asked Abraham to offer up his son Isaac on the altar. The language is that God tested Abraham when he did that. Well, this is a related word to that. A trial is a circumstance that tests us, that shows what we're made of ultimately. We can see it a little in the English word. We lose sight of this. We talk about trials as if they just mean troubles, going through trials, meaning I'm having a hard time. But the word trial, it comes from the idea of trying something, to try it to see what's going on. A trial in the sense of like when someone is taken to trial to see whether a certain charge against them is true or false. That's the English translation trial has a hint of that, but it doesn't quite bring out the full flavor of it, I don't think. The idea of this word is things that test us. Well, this word focuses on the testing process, those things that test us. It is often used in conjunction with another word group that emphasizes more the result of that testing, the proof or approvedness, approval, those kinds of words. That is, you've gone through the test and the proof has emerged. The result is in, and we can see that indeed it is true. Well, James uses that word group as well when he talks about the proving of our faith. This word group is very important in the New Testament as well. The concept that ultimately in this life we are being proven, we are being tested, and ultimately the result is seen, that there is something real there. There is something going on. So what James is talking about are those kinds of circumstances that test us and ultimately provide a certain proof that something is going on in our lives. This brings us then to the second question, which is, what's being tested? What kind of a test are we talking about here? Well, James says specifically, it is the proving of our faith. And first of all, it's important to just get in general terms that that is indeed what he's talking about. It is not my worthiness for salvation that is being tested. When you look at the evidence of my life, I am being tested every day as to what sort of person I am. And one of the things that is emerging as a result is that you can see that I am a sinner. I mean, the results are in. I hate to tell you, but the results are already in. They've been in for some time. And so that sort of testing, if we were to talk about seeing what sort of stuff you're made of, well, I could tell you what sort of stuff I'm made of. I show it all the time. But that's not what James has in mind, I would argue. His concept is that these trials are proving our faith. There is this thing that he's calling faith that is being tested. Have you got that or not, is the issue. It's not testing how nice we are or how religious we are or any number of things that it's not testing. What it is testing is whether we have faith. Now, one of our goals in studying James is to understand what sort of thing he means by faith, and so what sort of testing does he have in mind? I mean, how do you test faith? What is it, and what do positive results look like? At this early point in the letter, obviously, James has not been specific. We will see with ever-increasing clarity the kind of thing he has in mind as we go through the letter. But I thought I would take a minute as we start into the letter to look at something that can kind of give us some background on this question. Because it seems to me, as you look through James, that James, as we would expect, shows a lot of influence from the teaching of Jesus. I mean, James did not follow Jesus around as one of the 12, but the fact is that as we saw, Jesus appeared to him after the resurrection, and clearly James, in becoming a leader in the Jerusalem church, has become a student of the teaching of Jesus. What is it that Jesus said? And we see ideas in his letter that harken back to things that Jesus said a lot. So it seems to me that it's relevant to look at what I think of as the key and fundamental teaching on this topic that we see in Jesus' teaching, and that is the parable of the sower. So I just want to talk about that for a second as background to what we're going to see here in James, to show that James is not the first one, although this is a very early letter, actually, I think probably the earliest of the letters in the New Testament. In fact, Jesus got in before him, that this is not a new idea that James is talking about here. Okay, so I'm going to sort of summarize, I'm going to draw elements from the accounts in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and just briefly talk about the parable of the sower to show you some parallels here. You may recall, Jesus tells a parable about a sower. He goes out and he's sowing. Obviously, he wants to have a harvest. He wants to raise up a crop, and so he's sowing seeds. But the seeds fall on different kind of ground. And Jesus tells this story as an analogy to the situation, the way different people respond to the gospel. The message of the gospel is being proclaimed everywhere like seeds being scattered on the ground. But what results from it depends on what sort of ground the seed falls on or what sort of heart is responding to the message. So the story goes basically like this. Jesus is saying, as you think about what happens when a sower goes out and sows, some of the seed falls beside the road, and that's where people have been tramping along. The ground is hard-packed by the road, and so the seed doesn't go into the soil. It just sits there on the top, and the birds come and eat it. And he says, so that's analogous to the person who just is immediately not interested in the gospel. They hear it, they say, that's not for me. It doesn't take any root of any sort, and the birds take it away. Some seed, he says, falls on shallow, rocky ground where it takes immediate root, but it withers. When the sun comes up, its roots are shallow. It can't stand up to the sun, and it withers and dies. This, he says, is like hearts which show an initial interest in the gospel, but it takes no firm and lasting root. In a time of testing, he says, when affliction or persecution arises because of the word, immediately they fall away. So notice here the concept. It's the same idea that we see in James, this idea of a time of testing. In a time of testing, they decide it's not for them. Then he talks about a third sort of ground. Some seed falls among the thorns, which grow up and choke out the plant. So also then, analogously, there are hearts which are double-minded. Other distractions compete with the gospel and choke it out. Such things as the worry of the world, the deceitfulness of riches, the desire for other things, the pleasures of this life. These are the various things that Jesus refers to. Distractions which come up and ultimately choke out the plant. They thrive, but the plant that was sown, that doesn't. And then finally, some seed falls on good ground and produces a good crop. The roots go deep. There's no competition. It can stand up to the sun. There's nothing competing with it, and it grows up and produces a crop. And so, he says, also, there are hearts that hold the word fast and bear fruit with perseverance. And here we have that same idea of perseverance that we see in James. So, if we sum up what we see here, there are three ways to go wrong in the way you respond to the gospel. You can be not interested from the beginning. You can be initially interested, but there is a cost for remaining a believer, and that cost is too high. I don't want to pay it. The troubles come, the persecutions come, and I say, this is not for me. Or I can be interested, but I'm more interested in something else. There is competition, and ultimately the worries of the world, the deceitfulness of riches, other desires, pleasures, these are the things that Jesus talks about. Those things become competition with my interest in the gospel, and ultimately they choke it out, and it gets nowhere. There's one way to go right, and that is, as he says, to hold fast to the word and persevere. I don't bail because the cost is too high. I don't lose interest in it because I am actually more attracted to other things. I hold fast to it. I hang in there. I do not let go of it. I do not lose interest in it. I continue to hold fast to it, to believe that it is true, to look to it for my life. That's the picture that Jesus paints. I think actually it's a very clever and at the same time very profound story that Jesus is telling. What kind of hearts do we have? Time will tell. The fact is that time is the great tester of who we are as people. Our initial interest in the gospel may go nowhere because the cost of believing is too high, or because we are seduced by other things that we want more. Or else, we will hold fast. We will continue to believe it, to look to its promises, to persevere in holding to it. That's the picture that Jesus paints. I would argue then that in a way the letter of James is like a real-life embodiment of the parable of the sower, the whole book, really. Because what Jesus is talking about in the parable is exactly what James is talking about throughout his letter. James is reminding his readers that God indeed tests our faith, and he is exhorting them to persevere in faith, both through hardships and through tempting distractions. I mean, those themes that we see written precisely in Jesus' story, we're going to see fleshed out in James' letter. For James, this idea of perseverance in the midst of the tests of our faith is obviously a very important and valuable thing. And that brings me to my third question then. Why is God doing this to us? We are talking about the God of the universe, the loving God whom I am counting on to save me, and yet he is putting me through hardships and suffering. I mean, that's what James is talking about. He's saying, rejoice, because God is beating you up. I mean, basically, when it comes right down to it, that's what he's saying. Now, actually, I have to qualify that. That's not what he's saying in a way, but in a way he is. How can that be right? I mean, how can anyone actually sanely and reasonably embrace a message like that? I mean, What is James thinking? This is not the kind of message that's going to bring them in. Because, I mean, isn't the idea to get out of the suffering and hardship stuff? Isn't that what I'm looking for? What would we think of a parent who decided, I need to put my kid through a series of tests, see what they're made of. Let's try, for the next week, we won't feed them anything. See how they do. And then, hey, the temperature's down below freezing now. Why don't I, I'll lock them out of the house. And then I'll look through the window and I'll watch and see, how are they doing? You know, they holding up out there? I mean, a parent who was to do something like that, we would think, was a monster. Right? I mean, wouldn't you? And yet God is not a monster. James is not embarrassed to be saying this. He isn't saying, oh, you got me here. I do have to admit that God does kind of put us through hardships, but let's not talk about that. I mean, he's saying, this is the way it works. Rejoice in it. That's a weird thing. So, why is God making life difficult for us? What is the purpose of this? Why would he do such a thing? Well, there are a lot of things that we might say to answer that, but in concentrating on what James is saying, he says we should rejoice in the midst of trials because we know that this process of proving our faith brings about perseverance. That's his answer. This is why you should rejoice, because you know that it brings about perseverance. Clearly, God sees our persevering in faith to be a valuable thing. So valuable that it is worth putting us through difficulties and trials so that it can come about. So, what is perseverance then? What are we talking about? Perseverance is that idea of hanging in there, of continuing on, of not giving up. At certain times in our lives, this is what I think we will see as we go through the book, and as indeed throughout the whole New Testament this is talked about. God uses circumstances to confront us with the question, what does the gospel mean to me? Following God has brought me hard things that I don't want. And following God has not brought me things that I do want. What am I going to do with that? Is it worth it? Is what God is promising to do in the gospel worth what it is costing me to embrace it and what I am losing in embracing it? In confronting these questions, though, I have to ask myself, is it worth it to me? Do I value the thing that God is doing so much that I can see that this is the road I want to go down? To persevere is to answer these questions with a yes. Yes, in spite of everything, I still believe the gospel. Yes, I still want what God has promised. So the big question then becomes, so what? What is so valuable about perseverance, if that's what it is, hanging in there, continuing on, confronting in a real way, in the midst of my life, the issue of what the gospel means to me, and continuing to embrace the gospel in the face of those questions? Why is that valuable? What is the value of going through a process like that? Well, I think James is going to help spell that out as we go along through the letter. But let me just give you a sneak preview of what we're going to be seeing and what he has to say. I would say that the value of perseverance, as James describes it, resides in two things. And there may be more things, but these are the two things that he talks about. First of all, it's this notion of proof. Perseverance provides proof that we are indeed believers who stand to inherit the kingdom of God. In the midst of trials, I discover what I am about. I see that, in fact, my interest in the gospel was not a temporary fling, that now I'm moving on to something else, but in fact, it is what I believe. It is what my life is about. And secondly, perseverance in the midst of trials brings about wisdom. I become a mature, more mature, more wise person than I was before by going through this process. This is what James is going to talk about. Perseverance through trials is valuable because I learn something about my own faith and I become a wiser person. That's what he's going to say. God is using difficult life experiences to show us that we are his and to teach us what we need to know. Now, we'll see the specifics of how he conceives of this as we go through the letter. And certainly one of the things that we will need to get specific about is what is the content of this faith that is being tested. Faith is not just a vague sort of feeling of faith. It is believing something. And so we want to be clear about what is it that we're believing and how is it that the circumstances of our life then are testing that belief. And James has some things to say about that, and we'll see that as we go along. But in general, we can say now that God clearly sees this process of testing as being for our benefit because of what we learn about our own faith and how we grow in wisdom. Which brings me then to my last question. Is he really serious about this rejoicing stuff? This has got to be one of the hardest things that we will encounter in the Bible. James starts out with one of the hardest ideas that we will wrestle with. The very first thing he says is one of the hardest things to swallow about Christianity. I mean, it's like the whole package all at once. Because the fact is that life is very hard. You know, I mean, I don't want to go on about my problems. And all of you have bigger problems than I do, I'm sure. But the fact is, as I go along, life gets harder. And as I look at the people around me, I know a lot of mature, from my perspective, mature believers. I admire a lot of the people in this community that I've known for many years. And I think very highly of you, and I admire the way you live your lives. But in that maturity that I see, I don't see that it has particularly made life easier for you. In a sense, it has, because wisdom has a very beneficial effect on our lives. But the fact is that for all of the wisdom that I think I see having been gained in the lives of many of you, it hasn't freed you from the troubles of life. And in fact, God comes along every now and again and really slams you up with stuff that's hard to deal with. I look everywhere I look. This is what I see. Everyone I know is having a hard time. I don't mean that they're unhappy. I don't mean that they go around frowning or swearing or complaining all the time, but it's tough. So to say rejoice in the midst of all of that is to say something pretty profound, either pretty stupid or pretty profound. And the question is, which is it? Is it stupid or profound? James is starting his letter here by confronting us with one of the fundamental and challenging truths of our faith. And I think it runs something like this. The value of the gospel is so real and should be so real to us that we can weigh it against suffering and hardship and still say, I'm coming out a winner. It is actually coming to have the perspective that the gospel is true. And being true, then, that means that I stand to inherit a great treasure. I am in the favor of God, and things will be well with me. There's a lot that we could say about what that message entails, but that's a fundamental truth of the gospel. Things will be well with me. If I hang in there with God, this is going to be good. But the way to get there is a hard road because this is a messed up world. And we have made a mess of ourselves. And it's going to take some serious surgery to solve this problem. This is Christianity 101. This is the basic deal. Hey, believe in the gospel and you will be saved. And being saved is a good thing. Not a bad thing, it's a good thing. And yet, being Christianity 101, it is still a thing that we will wrestle with our whole lives. To be able to say with James, yes, I agree. The trials that God has taken me through, I rejoice in them. To be able to say that is to come to a place of real understanding and maturity. Now, let me remind you that it's not just James who tells us that trials are a desirable thing. I see this all over the New Testament. You can't get away from it, really. Peter, in his letter in 1 Peter, says, "In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials, that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ." Notice Peter connecting this idea of trials, testing, proof of our faith together. And he's saying the proof of our faith is more precious than gold. And because of that, we rejoice in our circumstances. This is exactly what James said. Paul, in Romans 5, says, "And not only this, but we also boast in our tribulations, knowing that tribulation brings about perseverance, and perseverance, proof, and proof, hope." Notice here how Paul is connecting these same ideas together. Tribulations, but hey, the result is perseverance, and perseverance brings about proof. These are the same words that we saw from what James was talking about. And because we know this is happening, we boast in our tribulations. We exult in them. This is pretty strong stuff. Paul, James, Peter, they all seem to be either deluded in the same way or seeing something that it's hard for us to see, because they all have this same idea, that there is something valuable about this process. The thing that results from tribulations, from trials, from the testing of our faith, is so valuable that ultimately we can be glad that we went through it. That's what I think they're getting at. Now, I do want to be clear as we go along, and we'll keep saying this as we go along through the book. It is not the suffering that we are glad about. We are not masochists. It is not that we enjoy pain. Bring it on. I'm not suffering enough. Give me more. It is a serious mistake to say that Christians should be happy in the midst of suffering if what we mean by that is that somehow you are showing your lack of spirituality if you are suffering in the midst of your sufferings. If you're having a hard time and it makes life difficult and you don't feel so good, that is not a lack of spirituality. That's a terrible burden to lay on someone, to expect them not to suffer in the midst of their suffering. Unfortunately, a lot of the church does this. A lot of the church puts this kind of pressure on us, is that this is how we'll be able to tell whether you're a spiritual person, is you just had terrible loss and you're whistling and smiling and, hey, it didn't bother me. I think to not be bothered by serious loss is to be mentally ill, not to be spiritual. And in fact, we don't see that model in the Bible. I mean, we see Jesus suffering. We see Paul suffering. We see them going through difficulties and saying, this is hard. I mean, and these are our models. These are the people that we want to look up to. And yet they didn't say, oh, hey, no big deal going through this. I mean, what they do say, though, is, I trust in God to raise me up. In 2 Corinthians, Paul talks about things were so difficult when I was in Ephesus that I had pronounced a sentence of death upon myself. You know, I thought, this is it. I cannot go any farther. I'm going to die. And yet, he talks about how he put his trust in the God who raises the dead. this is more than I can take, but it's not more than God can handle. That's a spiritual attitude. So what Jesus, James, Paul, Peter, really all of the New Testament writers are saying is that salvation in the kingdom of God is so desirable, so valuable, that we rejoice in it even if we have to suffer along the way in the process of getting there. Now, that's a message at least that makes sense. It's not asking me to ignore how I feel about difficult things, but it is giving me perspective and saying, remember, there is something bigger going on than just the difficult circumstances that I find myself in. Okay, so I'd like to make a couple of closing comments here. First of all, it strikes me, and it probably strikes you, I mean, if this is the real deal, if this is in fact what's going on in the world, it really shows that God is very serious about what's going on in our lives in a way that we are not. I am constantly having to fight in myself, my own triviality, my own reducing life to, it's like I've got these big blinders on that stick out about that far and I can only see this just little square in front of me. It's just the stuff that's affecting me right now. Oh, things are okay, I'm happy. Oh, things are not okay, I'm not happy. And yet, the fact is that the reality of the world that I live in goes much beyond this little square that I'm looking at. The fact is that this age is temporary. God is real. I am going to stand before the judgment seat of God very soon. I mean, the sufferings of this life can seem interminable sometimes, but the fact is this is not going to last very long. And I am going to be standing before the one who can either bless me or curse me. If I have not bowed to him in repentance and faith, I will be lost forever. If I do bow to him in repentance and faith, I will be rescued from death, rescued from evil, and I will find true life. That's serious stuff. I can't get out of that by ignoring it. I can put on the blinders and just think about the stuff in front of me, but reality is going to come crashing in on me whether I do that or not. I will be dealing with my Creator somewhere along the line. I can deal with him now or I can deal with him later, as they say. That's what the story of my life is really about. Well, God never forgets that, even if I constantly do. So part of what this picture of God's willingness to put us through trials says is that he is very serious about our situation. He goes to work on me because serious things are at stake, things that I lose sight of often. But one of the things we have to do if we're going to have any chance of understanding our own lives is to get serious, to recognize that all I have is the choices in front of me. I have the option of being a person who responds to the goodness of God or rebels against the commands of God. I mean, what sort of person am I going to be? We think that our problems are all about getting rid of the obstacles that are in our way currently to happiness. Now, there's nothing wrong with trying to remove obstacles from our way. I try to remove obstacles from my way as often as I can, very unsuccessfully too, but I try it, and I'm not going to stop trying it as long as I live. But if reality is the way the Bible pictures it, if James is serious about what he's saying here, then in the midst of my difficulties, the most important thing I can do is to decide, how am I going to respond to God? And I see it all around me. I see, like I said, everyone I know has hardships. But I see some people in the midst of those hardships growing up and learning to trust God more. And I see other people in the midst of those hardships getting distracted, saying, I don't really have time to deal with God right now. That's a luxury that people who don't suffer have. But meanwhile, I have serious suffering to deal with, so I have to get in and solve my problems. Well, God's saying, you know, if you think that removing the immediate obstacles to happiness in front of you is what you really need to do to solve the problem of your life, then you have a very trivial understanding of your situation. I see it as much more serious than that, which is good for us, because if it were up to us, we never would solve this problem. My second observation is the Christian life pretty much promises to be one of character-building hardship. Most human beings throughout history have believed in a god or gods, but one of the striking features of many religious beliefs is that idea that you can tell whether God likes you or not by how your current circumstances are going. If things are going well for you, you are blessed by the gods. And if things are not going well for you, then you are not blessed by the gods. But the message of the Bible is quite different than that. It's saying you can tell whether God likes you by whether he cares enough about you to teach you the hard lessons of faith and wisdom. God shows his care by not ignoring me and leaving me to my trivial foolishness, but by teaching me, by growing me up. In our current religious climate, I think it's very important to remember that, because there are many, many voices out there that would like to convince us that the fundamental benefit of being a Christian is to make life more pleasant, prosperous, and healthy now. That's so much not a biblical message that it's hard for me to understand how anybody ever got convinced that it was a biblical message, but there are many who would say so. So, I mean, a book like James is, for many reasons, a profound antidote to that kind of thinking. Another observation I want to make, and I hope I can make this clear, this is very clear in my mind, but this is an idea that I find a lot of people don't... they don't get jazzed about this idea the way I do. So maybe I'm not seeing something, but for what it's worth, this is what I see here. And what I'm talking about is I see in James' words an indication about the importance of knowledge. Now, that doesn't sound bad. Yeah, but let me explain what I mean. James is urging us to do an astounding thing. He wants us to react to trials, to hardships that test our faith, by rejoicing. That, however you look at it, that is not an easy thing to call on someone to do. On what basis could he expect such a thing? What possible reason could we have to look at our sufferings and respond with joy? Why would a person do that? Well, what does he say? What he says is, consider it all joy when you encounter various trials, knowing that the proving up of your faith leads to perseverance. Because you know that something is true, you can see that it is appropriate to respond in this way. The Bible emphasizes the importance of a certain kind of knowledge. Now, I don't mean just, you know, facts, being able to correctly articulate the message of a particular passage may or may not lead to the kind of knowledge I'm talking about. But it is the awareness, the understanding that life is a certain way. It is to know, yeah, that's right. That's what God's doing. That's what is in front of me. That's where I am headed. That's what's going to happen to the world. That's what God has promised to do. Knowing those things gives me a basis upon which to actually respond differently to the circumstances of my life. You know, you just have to picture that kind of scenario where someone's going into a difficult situation. They're going to have to really persevere, and they're going to have to do some hard things. And someone comes along and says to them, you know, let me just remind you, that while you're in the midst of all of this stuff, that I'm going to be pulling for you. I'm available if you need help. Here's my phone number. Call me. I mean, it is the knowledge that, oh, yeah, someone, I'm not in this alone. Someone is going to help me out with this stuff that could actually make it so that I feel more confident and can take on the difficult situation with more equanimity. It's because I know something beyond the immediate circumstances that help me respond to it better. Well, that's what the Bible is saying. My circumstances that I find myself in are not just those circumstances alone. There is a bigger part of the picture. There is a purpose to this. There is one who is in charge. There is one that I can count on. The place that I'm trying to get is the very place that I want to be. So it's because I think that perspective is so important in life that, and I say this in all seriousness, my belief in the importance of this kind of knowledge, of the knowledge that can give you perspective on life, is the main reason that I am a teacher, that I stand up here and do this stuff. Because, I mean, there are benefits to being a person who stands up in front and teaches, but there are liabilities to it as well. What is it that I personally like about doing this? Is it having your attention, being the one in front, so you all look at me? You've all been looking at me for, you know, you've been looking at me like for 45 minutes. You've been sitting there looking at me and listening to me. I can't get enough of it. In fact, afterwards, I want everyone to come around and listen to me some more. Actually, strictly speaking, that's not true of me as a person. And in many ways, I've told you all of this, that in my career as a teacher, I kind of have these, you know, these cycles that I go through, that after a while, I get really sick of standing in front. I have this great desire to be sitting in the back and listening to somebody else. One of my current problems in life is that I started this series at that spot. I'm starting into months of teaching here with the desire to sit in the back and listen to somebody else. So, you know, so you can pray for me because I may get through this. But so what's the advantage? Why am I here? What is it that I like about doing this? And I'm saying in all sincerity that the things that I talk about here give me perspective on my life. These are the things that I think about as I'm dealing with the difficult things that I find in life. And the reason I like talking to you about them is because I think that they can give all of us perspective on those things. Now, you can't just stuff it into your brain and say, now I got perspective. And I can't stuff it into your brain and say, now you've got perspective. But that's what we're about here, ultimately. That's why the Bible keeps telling us to encourage each other and to remind each other of these things. Because we are reminding each other of the truths that we lose sight of easily, but that are in fact the defining truths of our existence. More important than the stuff that I'm looking at right in front of me. More substantial, more real, more important that I deal with in the right way. Now my final point is this. Hard thing for me to say. As you all know, everybody calls me Eeyore. For good reason. But my final point is to rejoice. As James says, I think we have reason to. In the hands of God, the hardships of our lives are not random and meaningless, but they are purposeful and necessary and leading to a highly desirable end. God is using hard means to bring about a wonderful result. And I know it is easy to lose sight of all of this, but that's all the more reason why it is important that we fight to remember. One of the important struggles of your life is to fight to remember what is true and important in the midst of the pressures and distractions of my life. The problems are big out there, but if all I see are the problems, I'm not seeing the world right, because God and His grace and His mercy are bigger than those problems, and it's that that is going to lead me to rejoice. Okay, so we got started late, so I'm going to take a minute for any comments or questions we might have. Right here. Does anybody have the mic? Thank you, Roger. Oh, okay. Back there and then up here.
I have a question. I'm not sure if my difficulty with this is not having come to a place of understanding this concept in my own life, or if it's a misunderstanding of the semantics of what joy is.
Okay.
When I hear the word joy, I immediately associate it with happiness.
Mm-hmm.
When I think of happiness, I associate it with a sense of elation that to me seems disconnected from right. from the trials and sorrow that we feel.
Right.
My understanding thus far is that my joy is inseparable from my sorrow in this life. And what I understand right now about joy to be is something more akin to hope than happiness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. And that's one of the things that we would want to try to pin down as we go along. Yeah, I think joy, happiness is that thing that results from circumstances that are all that I want them to be. I'm inside, I'm feeling good, I'm not sick, I'm not tired, good things are happening around me. Joy, though, I think is that response of satisfaction to something that is truly worthy of that response. That is, when I think about what God is doing in my life, it is what I want Him to do. I am not feeling good. I may be tired. I may be discouraged. I may be suffering. People may be mistreating me. I may be wrestling with the question of whether I'm going to forgive someone in some situation, and that's hard, and it's stressful, and I'm wrestling with that, and certainly there's turmoil. But there is this reality that I am looking at in the midst of that that gives me, that I look at with satisfaction. I look at it and say, yes, that's good. And so I understand joy to be not the feeling of well-being, but that response of yes, that is what I want. I am satisfied with that. Closely tied to hope in a life where the thing that I am looking to with satisfaction and joy is only beginning to become a part of my actual experience. I mean, I am looking forward to God's salvation, which He has begun in my life. The fact that I believe in Him and am actually learning to see the world a little bit the way He does is a product of His work in my life and is something to be satisfied with. But in comparison with how much the world is not what I would have it be, and my own understanding is not what I would have it be, and my circumstances are not what I would have it be, there's still a lot that is difficult in this life. So that which I am being satisfied with, that I'm responding to positively, is largely the promises of God, the fact that God has forgiven me and that He is indeed working to bring my life to its desired goal. And yeah, so hope and joy, I think, in that sense, are very closely tied together. But that's a very good point that you make there, and I should have brought that out more strongly, I think, because that captures this dichotomy that I want to say. We don't want to say to each other, you ought to be happy in the midst of your sufferings. But you ought to be hopeful, and you ought to be joyful in the sense that you recognize that this hard road is taking me to my desired destination. And that is something to rejoice in. That gets me up and takes me down the road again, because this road, although it's hard, is the road I want to be on. That's going where I want to go. So yeah, that's an important distinction. Thank you.
I'll try not to look at you.
It's too late. They're all doing it. You might as well.
I just wanted to kind of comment that I really, what you said about the perspective we get on life and the knowledge, that really hits home to me, because that's meant so much. I've known about belief in God all my life, and I think I struggle with this in the company of my extended family, people who are very strong in believing that they should do certain things for God. And I think genuinely wanting to do the right thing. But it seems like, and maybe you could comment on, if you see this just in our culture and world history in general, it seems like there's a lot more acceptance of our understanding that we have to believe something, or that it's good to reach out and see that there's more than what's just here. But it doesn't seem like there's much available or much desire even to look at, you know, to have that perspective, like you're saying, to come to know what's really, even like with the Bible, what's really being said there.
Right.
That when you begin to really look into it, you see it tied together. So, you know, there's something here that really ties through. But
yeah.
Why is that just not available?
Well, I think that's a complicated question, actually. I mean, there are a lot of things that contribute to it. I think we do need to recognize. I don't mean to characterize anyone out there or in any particular way, but it is true that the kind of perspective that I'm talking about is hard won. It requires you to really challenge your own perspectives on yourself. And it is very easy, much easier than doing that, to embrace a religious perspective that puts kind of a nice little frosting of God on the top of what is basically the same perspective on life that I've always had. That I see fundamentally my goal in life is to be happy now, to have more money now, to be thought well of by other people, to think of myself well, to think, gee, I'm a great person for doing all these things. I mean, there's all kinds of current benefits that can come to me. Jesus uses the language when he talks about the Pharisees, you have your reward in full. You know, you already got what you were looking for. You're not really looking to God for what he is planning to do with the world. It's like right now there is a prize to be won by being a religious person. So the fact is that in all sorts of religious environments, it is easy to embrace the trappings of the religion and yet keep the perspective fundamentally what we call worldly. You know, saying the values of this world are pretty much what I embrace, but I like the idea that God's going to make it easier for me to get what I want. On the other side, to actually pick up the challenge of saying, you know, Here's what's really going on. This is so much a reality of the way things are that if I lose out on this, I don't care what I get in this life, I'm a loser. And if I gain it, I don't care what I lose in this life, I am still a winner. That's perspective. And that's not just knowing some things that there is a God who's made some promises, but actually coming to embrace them and believe that they're true and that they make a difference. So in some ways, I think it's the kind of thing that a person only really learns through the process of trials that James is talking about here. This is the kind of wisdom that results. When he talks about wisdom, I think this is the kind of wisdom he means, that I'm actually seeing the implications of the faith for the life that I live. Okay, let's do one more. I know we're late, but we started kind of late.
You started off with a brief comment that I found very refreshing about the word brethren.
Yes.
And that in essence it meant that people are in different points of life and grappling with what the gospel is. So, and that the book of James is really about salvation and atonement, and therefore it seems a little bit incompatible with kind of the reductionistic Pauline Romans road, this is what the gospel is, take it or leave it, black or white mentality. I guess therefore, this being my first day here, I'm unclear exactly as to what you mean by the word gospel. And it's something I think I like, but I'd like to hear more exactly how you define that.
Okay.
I guess the nuts and bolts of it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very good question and a very big question because there's a lot involved in it. I don't know whether you're going to have a second or third time coming back here, but these are things that I will be talking about as we go along. The gospel, I'm going to make this brief and then put a frame around it. The gospel is the message that God, through Christ, is making available to mankind a way to solve the problem of our guilt before God, to solve the problem of our moral incapacity, the evil of our natures, to solve the problem of death and futility and all of that. And what we are called to do is to respond to that message by believing it, by repenting, by saying, I have been wrong about God, He is there, and what He is doing in Christ is what I need. Now, there's a lot. That's not a very good answer, but I want to emphasize. I agree with you about that Romans Road kind of mentality. It's a difficult balancing act that we're trying to make here. That I think James and Paul totally agree about the nature of faith and what is involved. Paul is emphasizing faith as opposed to works in the sense that there are those who think that their religious obedience has made them worthwhile to God. I can tell that you're not in favor with God because you don't do what I do. Okay? That's the mentality that Paul is speaking to and saying, no, nobody is going to get saved that way. We are all sinners who can only be saved by the grace of God. And so thus by believing the promise of the gospel for that forgiveness rather than trying to earn God's favor. What James is emphasizing is that faith is not a trivial thing. That it's not just saying, oh yeah, okay, I'll buy that, now let's move on to something else, but rather to believe that I am a sinner, that God is real, that He is offering me mercy, that life is to be found in the kingdom of God rather than in this world ultimately. To believe that is to embrace something that is entirely different than the picture that the world around me embraces, and it's going to have an effect on the way I do things. It's going to have an effect on the way I live. So, yeah. The Bible, I think, is painting a picture that the business of my life as a Christian, from the moment I become a Christian throughout my existence, the business of my life is to be a believer, to confront the next thing that comes my way, and in those circumstances to continue to believe the gospel, that God is good, that God will save me, that life is to be found in His kingdom, and so on. So, and I don't think Paul and James disagree on that. We can talk more about that if you want. Okay, so I went really late. I know. So we're done. Thanks.